Hi, I am Melanie Kushnarecki, and today I'm going to be presenting to you a webinar on individualized evidence-based practices in women's health, what you need to know regarding dietary supplements or natural health products, and when to use them in your clinical practice. I'm a naturopathic doctor from Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and I have a small private practice with focus in women's health, pediatrics, and mental health. I graduated from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine in Toronto, Ontario, and I also hold a Bachelor's of Science in Plant Biology from the University of Ottawa. I am a member of the Canadian Association of Naturopathic Doctors, as well as the International Society for Complementary and Alternative Medicine Research. I am also a member of the Réseau Québécois d'Action pour la Santé des Femmes, which is an organization that educates and empowers women in their health concerns, as well as defends women's rights within the healthcare system. I would also like to take this opportunity to disclose that I do work for the company New Roots Herbal, which is based out of Vaudreuil-Dorion near Montreal, Quebec. You will see I will be using and describing some of their products throughout the webinar to support some of my concepts. I work for the company as a naturopathic consultant, and I have to say that I stand behind the company because of their quality control and the safety I feel about recommending their products to my clients is very important for me. And they are a company with a very strict quality control, probably one of the highest standards in North America. And that's because they are one of the few companies that has a fully accredited certified 17025 laboratory, which has different scientific and analytical equipment like HPLC or chromatographies or spectrophotometers that are used for substance identification, such as plant extracts, amino acids, enzymes, vitamins, minerals, those types of things, as well as the identification of the presence of pesticides, solvents, heavy metals, or other chemicals that could be potentially found in natural health products. So it's a company that I stand behind and feel confident in recommending to my clients. If you like more information about the company or its laboratory, you will find information at the end of this webinar where you can contact us. So without further ado, I would like to begin the webinar. So there's a variety of different topics in women's health that can be covered. From the menstrual cycle to certain conditions, fertility, gynecological, menopause, bone, pregnancy, cancers, mental health, etc. There's a huge array of topics. For this presentation, I'm going to be presenting some concept that kind of weave through these topics without going into much detail in any of them thoroughly, as this webinar is just a general overview of some of the basic tools that you could apply straight away for your women clients. So as a naturopathic doctor, I generally like to take a sort of stepwise approach while considering a holistic approach. I usually find that simple strategies are most effective for compliance, as well as are more easily able, as well as a practitioner, you'll be more easily able to identify what are some of the things that work well in different conditions. So in women's health, there's many different approaches you could take. I generally start with dietary to begin, looking at caloric intake to ensure healthy hormone synthesis, to look at antioxidant support or phytochemicals to support healthy detoxification of estrogens. I would look at the microflora, the genitourinary tract for any issues involving involving the genitourinary tract, as well as the microflora of the digestive tract, which can be involved with hormone reuptake as part of estrogen and progesterone metabolism. I would also greatly consider stress hormones and insulin, as these are both intertwined with the endocrine system and can subsequently affect women's health concerns. Included in this would be a thyroid hormone. Lastly, I would also consider the toxic burden. So investigating whether there's any particular environmental exposures or chemicals, things that act as xenoestrogens that could be affecting women's health concerns. Not mentioned here, but one that I find of equal importance and absolutely necessary to discuss with my clients, are culture, stigmatization, psychology, body image. These are very important topics that I will bring into my practice. That can be factors, especially in hormone regulation, the psychoneuroimmunological foundation is well established. And so as a natural practitioner, it's often something that I would also consider as part of my approach in addressing their concerns. So before we get started, and naturally at the end of this webinar, I would invite you to check out a website of a naturopathic doctor from Australia. I do not have any affiliation with her. I simply stumbled across her website and also was reminded of her website from a client recently. And I went through it and found it very valuable and had accurate information that's easy to understand about the menstrual cycle, about women's conditions, things like PCOS, endometriosis. And then also she has written a book called The Period Repair Manual that is excellent for anybody coming off the birth control pill or who's having trouble having a consistent or healthy menstrual cycle. So I definitely would invite you to check out her website. So let's start. I would like to begin this webinar with some very simple, basic solutions, probably ones you've heard of before, but I wanted to present to you the science behind them, just so you can have some extra support in your rationale, in your decision-making process. That way you feel confident in giving the best advice, and that way you could be your best healthcare provider by doing the due diligence to have on hand these resources and this information that is being discovered with science. So I wanted to bring your attention to vitamin D. Vitamin D is a vitamin that we've all heard of. We all are aware of its role in health and its importance in health. But I did want to highlight some other specifications of vitamin D. So it's a fat-soluble vitamin that acts as a steroid hormone. And its role as a steroid hormone is most known in its function as calcitriol, which is involved in calcium homeostasis. Namely in its impact in bone health. But vitamin D more recently has also been demonstrated to have other hormone-like activities, particularly on the reproductive, organs, like the ovary, the placenta, the uterus, the vagina, and the testes. There are vitamin D receptors on these organs, and vitamin D has been implicated in testosterone production, for example, therefore has a role in sex hormone synthesis. There was a study that demonstrated men with low serum vitamin D also tended to have low serum testosterone. And when they had supplemented with vitamin D, their vitamin D levels went up, And their testosterone levels went up, which their testosterone did not occur in the control group that received placebo. Another function of vitamin D is in the insulin pathway. So there are vitamin D receptors on the pancreatic beta, on the beta cells of the pancreas. And so vitamin D has been implicated in the action of insulin secretion. We're also now, or science now is also looking at the vitamin D receptor polymorphism, which means that if there is a single nucleotide that is switched within the genetic blueprint of the vitamin D receptor, there may be a potential link with these types of polymorphisms and associations with different women's health conditions like PCOS, infertility, endometriosis, and hormone-sensitive cancers. However, the jury is not out yet whether these genetic polymorphisms are in fact the cause of these conditions or whether it's just an association. However, there is strong evidence pointing to vitamin D deficiency in PCOS. There's been several studies and in even intervention studies demonstrating the role in regulating particularly androgen and insulin in PCOS, and as well in hormone-sensitive cancers like breast cancer, there is a large body of evidence demonstrating its role in that condition. But what I wanted to highlight particularly today is the role of vitamin D in fibroids. So I wanted to bring to your attention the uterine fibroid study, which was conducted by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences between 1996 and 1999. So there are a series of about 15 studies that looked at the risk of uterine fibroids as it relates to factors in the environment, hereditary, lifestyle, as well as the biological changes in tissue to look at what are the factors that can promote the initiation of fibroids and what are the factors that can promote its growth. It was a study done in approximately 1,400 women. And what was different about this large study compared to other fibroid studies was that they actually implemented ultrasound, which was more accurate in terms of looking at the progression of fibroids. So it's common knowledge to know that women of African descent have a higher prevalence of fibroid risk. And so the results of this study wanted to look at whether Africans versus Caucasians had different roles of vitamin D in the fibroid growth, particularly since vitamin D, as we know, is mainly obtained through the sun, and African having darker skin tone do not absorb as much sunlight or vitamin D and therefore could potentially have an increase. And this could potentially explain for the increased risk of fibroids. But what was interesting with this study was that irrespective of Caucasian or African, there was an obvious association with vitamin D deficiency and fibroids. And the results of this study demonstrated that there was a 32% reduced odds when there's a sufficient vitamin D levels. Another aspect or another study involved in this large cohort study was looking at the role of vitamin D and cycle length. So in terms of menstrual cycle length, what is known is the length of the cycle is predominantly determined by the follicular phase. This is the phase from day one to ovulation. The luteal phase is often quite regular amongst women. So usually the luteal phase is anywhere between 12 to 17 days. But long or short cycles are generally due to irregularities in the follicular or first half of the phase. And so this study was then looking at women with long, short, or irregular menstrual cycles, not on birth control pill. And we're looking at whether vitamin D levels had any influence on the follicular development, which is the first half of the menstrual cycle. And so what they found was a decrease in serum vitamin D levels of 25 nanomoles per liter was associated with 1.9 times the odds of a regular cycle. So this information was basically useful in that it could potentially point to a role of vitamin D in the follicular phase of the menstrual cycle. So some of the conclusions that can be drawn from these studies are that vitamin D tends to be associated with the follicular phase of the cycle. And these studies also have demonstrated that vitamin D tended to be involved in the regulation of NAH, which is the anti-Müllerian hormone needed for follicular development. So normally we want this hormone to be low, and in women who have irregular cycles or who are having issues or who are having concerns regarding ovulatory function, this anti-Müllerian hormone tends to be elevated. And what the results of the studies have found was that vitamin D tends to help regulate this hormone, meaning that the higher levels of vitamin D or vitamin D sufficiency tends to decrease AMH hormone. Not indicated in this presentation, but this theory of vitamin D involved with AMH may possibly explain the inverse relationship with PCOS, insulin sensitivity, and hyperandrogenism, which is becoming a more robust evidence to demonstrate the role of vitamin D in helping to regulate some aspects of PCOS, and potentially, as we discussed earlier in the slides, in its role with fibroid growth and development. Here is another study, a preliminary study looking at vitamin D and menstrual disorders. It was a study involving 77 students looking at low versus normal levels of vitamin D. In the low vitamin D group, 40% of participants reported having long cycles. 27% were classified as having very few menstrual cycles, and 13% is having no menstrual cycles. In the normal vitamin D group, only 12% reported a menstrual cycle disorders, 6% few cycles, and 6% with no cycles. And so the conclusions made from this study were that women who did not meet the recommended level of 75 nanomoles per liter of serum vitamin D had almost 5 times the odds of having menstrual cycle disorders as women who were above the recommended vitamin D levels. Next, I'd like to bring your attention to selenium and folate, and what is the evidence for these nutrients in the synthesis of hormones. So I wanted to bring your attention to another large cohort study called the BioCycle study. This study was done during 2005 to 2007. It took place in New York City in approximately 260 women between the ages of 18 to 44. It were prospective cohort studies. There were over 70 papers published on this study, and the study was looking at the basic menstrual cycle function in particular, as it relates to diet and lifestyle. And it also wanted to understand the role of hormones and oxidative stress. And so this study is an excellent resource to sift through and read, as it speaks about what sort of dietary factors can influence the cycle and the need for doctors to take an approach related to the women's cycle when dealing with nutrition, lifestyle, and other aspects of a woman's health. So one of the conditions that they explored was something called luteal phase deficiency, LPD. In common language, we might call this progesterone deficiency. I put this in quotations because there is no real established bottom line of progesterone. And progesterone deficiency would actually be considered as zero, because anything above one is considered normal. And so there is no real progesterone deficiency. However, there are links between changes in the luteal phase and women having reproductive difficulties. So this particular study was looking at ovulatory cycles, which means that there's in women's health, there's differences between cycles that do not ovulate and cycles that ovulate, with deficiencies in the second half or with changes in the first half. And so this study was looking at women who did ovulate and had relatively a shorter luteal phase, which means that the luteal phase was less than 10 days and the peak progesterone was less than 10 nanograms per milliliter. So it is thought that around 4 to 9% of healthy women of reproductive age experience this type of kind of progesterone deficiency, if you will. Common knowledge is to suspect that these are women who have low caloric intake or high energy expenditure. They tend to have low mean estradiol, LH, and FSH, therefore lower levels of all hormones. And there is some but limited research suggesting that antioxidant support might be beneficial in women who have shorter luteal phases. So in this particular study, they were actually looking at diet in women with LPD. And what was particularly striking and left me with a question mark was that in healthy women of reproductive age, after adjusting for age, body fat, and total energy intake, a Mediterranean-style diet with high amounts of fruits and vegetables, isoflavones, and vegetable protein were positively associated with LPD, which means that the more a woman ate a vegetarian-based diet with monounsaturated fats, had higher incidences of progesterone deficiency. And then the second finding of the study was that selenium was negatively associated, which means that the higher the selenium, the lower the incidence of LPD. So I had to, ask myself, why would a vegetarian diet be associated with a progesterone deficiency when results of many studies demonstrates that a plant-based diet tends to improve hormone-related conditions, in particular cancers? So what was discovered was that in vegetarians, there's an enzyme producing bacteria in the gut that tends to be lower in people who consume a high fiber diet. And this enzyme is called beta-glucuronidase. And this enzyme is actually responsible for the reuptake of estrogen and progesterone in the intestine to recirculate back into the system. And so in vegetarians, this enzyme is decreased, which means that there's less reabsorption of these reproductive hormones in the colon. And therefore, it is suspected that that's what causes the decrease in levels of progesterone. At the same time, women who are prone to more estrogen dominant conditions, like things like fibroids or breast cancer or other hormone sensitive cancer, this is why vegetarian diets might be protective, is because of this enzyme that is responsible for the reuptake. However, in women who are at risk for progesterone deficiency, this would need to be considered when you're devising your plans. Alongside the Mediterranean style diet is the infertility diet. And so this particular diet, the fertility diet, is high in monounsaturated fats, in vegetable protein, in iron, in high fat dairy, and multivitamins, while low in trans fats, animal protein, and low fat dairy. These have been associated with a decreased risk of ovulatory infertility, which means that infertility due to a issue in ovulation. However, results of the BioCycle study demonstrate that women who have an infertility that is due to LPD, so not necessarily due to an ovulatory dysfunction, tends to have a different pattern, or does not tend to respond to this type of, quote, fertility diet. And so essentially what these results are saying is if the cause of the infertility needs to be properly investigated or diagnosed in order to make the best suggestions in diet. And so, you know, a sweeping sort of overall suggestion would be that women who suffer from an ovulatory issue would benefit from this fertility or high plant-based diet with dairy. However, a woman who has a progesterone deficiency with no ovulatory dysfunction might benefit from increasing actually what the study is saying is that the plant-based diet might not necessarily resolve the issue of progesterone deficiency. So one of the take-homes that I found particularly helpful or beneficial or can be applied is the second finding of the study, which is that selenium can decrease the odds of luteal phase deficiency or progesterone deficiency. And the results of the study demonstrated that twice the daily recommended amount, so roughly 110 micrograms of selenium, can result in a 77% reduction of luteal phase deficiency. So overall, macronutrients and micronutrients are important dietary considerations when looking at the menstrual cycle in women. So what about anovulatory cycles? So these are cycles where ovulation is not occurring. So as we mentioned earlier, the menstrual cycle tends to have a menstrual cycle has two phases, the follicular and the luteal phase. And what stimulates ovulation or what stimulates follicular growth is estrogen, and the luteinizing hormone is then what stimulates ovulation. And so what are some of the considerations in a woman who is not ovulating? So these are most commonly or can be found in women who have PCOS, but not all women with not every woman who does not ovulate has PCOS. In fact, the diagnosis of PCOS is actually very tricky and can present and I believe they are reconsidering it or reconsidering naming it something else, just because cysts on the ovaries tend to be or can be normal, and women with cysts does not always present with the same symptom patterns as a woman with PCOS. And so coming back then, what can be some of the other causes of anovulation or potential relationships? And what they found was a higher level of plasma homocysteine concentrations tended to have a link with ovulation. And the vitamin folic acid tends to have an inverse relationship. So what they found in the study was that higher plasma homocysteine concentrations were associated with lower total estradiol across the cycle. Higher serum folate concentrations were associated with higher luteal phase progesterone. And the higher the ratio of folate to homocysteine at ovulation was associated with a 10% decreased risk of anovulation. And so the homocysteine metabolism takes place with the cofactor of folic acid. So I'm going to switch gears now and talk a little bit about the gynecological health concerns. And my line here is most of the time, do nothing. So in most situations, the vagina can reestablish itself. It has a very, I don't know how to say this, but I guess it has a very strong capacity for self-healing, for regenerating, and for maintaining maintaining its balance. However, that is not always the case. There are instances when the symptoms persist or become chronic. And so generally speaking, as a natural health practitioner, we might come across women who have recurring urinary tract infections, chronic and persistent yeast infections, or chronic bacterial vaginosis, which is a condition caused by higher pH or lower acidity within the vaginal tract. Just to note that acute attention might necessitate a medical doctor before using natural health products. However, there are instances where natural products can be effective in prevention. So, looking at the vaginal microflora is a common area of our practice, and what is available now over the counter are probiotic vaginal suppositories of lactobacillus, which is the acid-forming bacteria, and has been demonstrated to help in reestablishing the vaginal pH. And this can help prevent the proliferation of harmful E. coli for urinary tract infection, as well as Gardnerella infections as seen in bacterial vaginosis. And so, a suppository of beneficial probiotic in the vaginal tract, even for a short term, can help reduce the reoccurrence of urinary tract infections as well as BV. And there are scientific studies demonstrating the usage of probiotics for these conditions. And these can be helpful as a prevention, especially if there's a disturbance as it relates to diet, to stress, or taking certain medications like antibiotics. These can contribute to the appearance of uropathogenic bacteria involved in urinary tract infections or in yeast infections. It's also noted that oral probiotics, in addition to vaginal probiotics, might be helpful in prevention of urinary tract infections as the bacteria passes through the digestive tract and the proximity of the vagina to the anus. There can be a beneficial effect in decreasing particularly urinary tract infections. And so women who have chronic UTIs may benefit from oral probiotics as well. Cranberry has been demonstrated to reduce the incidence of UTI by 26% in a systematic review and meta-analysis in 2017. Cranberry, the mechanism is to reduce the adhesion of the bacteria to the uroepithelium, which is the bladder wall. And so it's an effective, it can be an effective strategy for UTI prevention and bladder or recurring bladder infections. The cranberry in a supplement form might be more easily administered than the juice. However, the juice, so long as it's not fortified or not, or there's no sugar added to the juice, that it's the natural 100% cranberry, diluted half with water, can be used as well as a prevention. And also a treatment for E. coli-based infections. So most of the research on cranberry is for E. coli. And so there are other causative agents in UTIs. So for a proper workup and to know whether cranberry is right for your patient, you would need to know what is the organism responsible for the dominant organism responsible for the UTI bladder infection. Another natural product that tends to be helpful for some women is D-mannose. D-mannose is a naturally occurring sugar found from corn. The mechanism, similarly to cranberry, is that it prevents type 1 Fimbria E. coli from adhering to the cells of the bladder, as well as it's been demonstrated to remove the biofilm, which is a sort of organism that a non-bacterial adherence that that keeps the thriving of the bacteria growing. And so the D-mannose might have implications in removing this biofilm, which could then decrease the reoccurrence of bladder infections. A study was demonstrated using 1.5 grams twice daily for 3 days, then once per day for 10 days, to women with acute UTI or chronic UTI. There were 43 women in this study. There was a significant effect on the resolution of UTIs and quality of life, and a significant improvement in the majority of symptoms. Compared to placebo, compared to the control, after 6 months, there was a decrease in recurrence by 4.5% compared to the control, which was 33.3%. Additionally, there were not many reported side effects. New Roots has an excellent triple action formula, which contains a high concentrate of cranberry, as well as a high dose of D-mannose, so it's 4.8 grams per serving, compared to the 1.5 grams that was seen in the study. Additionally, it has contents of the Lactobacillus rhamnosus, which is the probiotic most commonly associated with women's health concerns and has been demonstrated in the scientific literature to be more effective in managing genital urinary concerns. What I like about New Roots' product is that it's a great tasting powder. It's not a pill, and so women could actually eat it right off the spoon and follow it with some water. And as well is that in Spain, they had conducted a very small, non-published, open-label study with 20 women who had a history of recurring cystitis in the last year. So the participants had to have had between 2 to 12 recurring cystitis in the last year. They were between the ages of 37 to 81 years, except for one young girl who was 7 years of age. And results of the study demonstrated that 90% of the symptoms after 1 week had decreased. And then after the 30-day follow-up, which was a month after the end of the treatment regime, there was an 84% reduction in recurrence of urinary tract infections due to E. coli. So what about bone and cardiovascular health? What can we say, what kind of simple interventions can you use alongside your dietary and lifestyle approaches? So I wanted to bring your attention firstly to the New Roots Herbal product, Strong Bones. The issue of calcium and bone health is a very interesting topic in the scientific literature. I'm going to be touching briefly about it, but I did want to bring to your attention why this product is particularly, or how it can be particularly helpful for you in practice. So, you know, a bone formula is generally recommended when we feel diet is not enough. And so when calcium intake, or if there's factors that are increasing calcium excretion, or there's other minerals or nutrients that are not adequate in the diet, then we would want to think about supplementing with a good quality calcium and other nutrients for bone health. And what stands out with the New Roots is that we use calcium, phosphorus, and collagen sourced from a microcrystalline hydroxyapatite, or MCHA. And in the scientific literature, you will find that this source of calcium, which has a 2-to-1 ratio of calcium to phosphorus, is significantly more beneficial than compared to calcium carbonate on reducing fractures and for increasing a bone mineral content and bone mineral density. So I've listed a study here in 2011 that actually has demonstrated that this type of calcium could actually increase bone mineral density and bone mineral content. And the microcrystalline hydroxyapatite, why it's more beneficial is because it actually contains collagens, which is the peptide needed for bone, vasculature, the skin, any connective tissue requires collagen. It's the second most abundant protein in the body. And this is naturally sourced in this MCHA, as well as it contains insulin growth factors and osteocalcin, which are hormones needed to get calcium into the bones. So these factors are present in the MCHA, making it that much more beneficial in women and in men too, with osteoporosis or susceptible to osteoporosis. In 2005, there was a study in Ukraine demonstrating MCHA is being far superior in helping to heal fractures in women with osteoporosis. As well, in 2015, there was another study on 74 perimenopausal women demonstrating that this source of calcium can actually improve knee and back pain associated with osteoporosis. And so hands down, for your osteoporotic clients, the MCHA is the source to get. And in this formula, we also have magnesium, which in studies have been demonstrated to, in small studies, have been demonstrated to increase bone mineral density, as well as small amounts of boron, which can help to reduce calcium and magnesium excretion. There's also trace minerals and amino acids, which are implicated in the construction of the bone matrix. And again, small studies have demonstrated that these trace minerals are more effective at reducing the bone loss compared to not having these trace minerals. So other important points to consider in bone health, peak calcium deposition for the prevention of osteoporosis occurs during adolescence. And so it is known that ensuring that adolescent girls are achieving peak calcium intake can reduce their risk of osteoporosis by 50%. Exercise has also been demonstrated to have important roles for calcium deposition, especially in boys. Reducing calcium leaching from bones or excess calcium excretion from the kidneys are major factors for life. And then I also want to touch on the 2016 alarmist study that demonstrated that calcium supplementation can increase risk of heart attack. So this here is just a quick diagram of a study done in 2013 looking at the effects of physical activity on bone health during life stages. So in fact, physical activity or PA is more important, is crucial for boys. And it's equally as important for girls, but compared to adults. So if your adolescent is sitting on the couch, you know, throughout the whole adolescence and then says, oh, I'm going to exercise when I get older to prevent bone loss, it's not going to happen. So the research has demonstrated now that the physical activity during adolescence is more important than the physical activity during adulthood. However, for women, it's physical activity across the board. So from adolescence all the way through to adulthood actually has a greater predictor of bone health. So for women, it is important that she continues exercising throughout her entire life. And the side benefit is that it's good for mental health. So those are also equally engaging and founding reasons to encourage exercise in your practice. So this here was pulled from a textbook called Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism. It's an excellent textbook. It's a little outdated, 1995, but it does give a brief synopsis of what are the other players involved in bone health and what could influence calcium homeostasis. So as we can see, protein can both enhance calcium absorption as well as increase its excretion. And so the amount of protein, particularly from animal sources, is important to consider. We also see that excessive fiber can inhibit calcium absorption, as well as oxalic acid and phytic acids common in a lot of vegetables. And so ensuring the appropriate calcium homeostasis and balance is very important even in healthy individuals. So going back then to that big study that demonstrated that calcium supplementation can increase risk of heart attack. So not too long afterwards, Harvard had published a very interesting letter mentioning that there's no good scientific evidence that calcium supplements can harm your heart. So essentially, results from studies afterwards demonstrated that the studies looking at calcium supplements and heart disease did not paint the or were not properly carried out. And the bottom line is that women with osteoporosis have an increased risk of heart disease. And so the results of the study were not correct in concluding that it was due to the calcium supplementation. So it's still unclear, what are the underlying mechanisms between bone health and heart health, although I will bring up something very, very shortly. But the consensus or the overall opinion is that calcium from dietary sources at high intake, so anywhere upwards of 1,000 to 1,200 milligrams per day, tend to be protective for your heart, and I will add for your blood pressure as well. And that they suspect that calcium supplements might potentially increase the risk. It's because if you're getting a high amount of calcium in one bolus or in one time, that might be the precipitator for calcification. However, if, like for example, in the strong bones, you're getting 150 milligrams per capsule, the suggested intervention then would be to take multiple spread out dosages. That way, your client would not be getting high amounts of calcium in any one dose. The other factor in this Harvard letter, they even go on to say that in an intervention study, they implemented women with osteoporosis with supplemental calcium, compared to placebo or control who did not, and the women who received this supplemental calcium did not experience any increased risk of heart disease. Therefore, the results extrapolated from an observational study are weaker than the results extrapolated from an intervention study. And so more intervention studies need to happen in order to properly assess whether calcium supplementation is good or bad for your heart. But the overall view is that the research was not properly conducted. It wasn't even the primary outcome measure that they were looking at. Therefore, the role of calcium is still important in heart health and in bone health. So if there is a susceptibility to heart disease, or if your client is still worried, or if your client is also demonstrating kidney disease or kidney failure, what is the single most basic intervention that you could use? It is vitamin K2. So vitamin K2, in my opinion, is an excellent dietary intervention, and the science is becoming quite convincing that it could be a helpful protocol, obviously for certain individuals. There are exceptions. And so the role of vitamin K2 in particular is that it binds calcium into the bones and it directs free calcium away from the arteries. There are over 20 published studies demonstrating the role of vitamin K2 in bone and cardiovascular health. Vitamin K2 is different from vitamin K1. Vitamin K1 is the anticoagulant found in green leafy vegetables. Vitamin K2, there's different forms, and the forms are denominated by the MN, which stands for menaquinone, and the number is the amount of chains that it has. So The most commonly researched forms of K2 are MN4 and MN7, MN4 being short chain and MN7 being long chain. MN4 is commonly found in cheese, in particular hard cheeses, as well as high amounts in poultry and in pork. Whereas MN7 has only been found in fermented soybeans, a Japanese just called natto. And so it's more rare to have MN7 in your diet. However, most people will have amounts of MN4 in their diets. New Roots has a vitamin K2 MN7, and this form is a synthetic MN7. However, there have been bioavailability and bioequivalent studies with the natural fermented form, as seen in the natto. And so you can look up the reference to assess the safety of the synthetic MN7, as well as it's in the all trans form, which is the more bioavailable form of MN7, the isomer that is most effective for establishing serum values. I would like to point out that the K2 MN7 is the only form of vitamin K approved by the European Food and Safety Authorities. And it's a convenient dosing in liquid. It's easily absorbed, easy compliance, so it's not a capsule. So how does vitamin K2 work? Essentially, it is part of the vitamin, or it's involved in activating two important hormones, osteocalcin and MGP, which stands for matrix GLA protein. And these hormones are responsible for directing free calcium from the arteries or from the vascular smooth muscle cell into the osteoblast, or the cell that promotes bone formation. And so vitamin K2 is involved in changing these two hormones from the uncarboxylated form to the carboxylated form, which allows them for increased bone growth and reduced calcification. So here are a list of several studies over the short and long term, up to 3 years, in postmenopausal women. Just bringing your attention here to the study by Knappen in 2013, 244 women over 3 years have demonstrated significant improvement in bone mineral density and bone mineral content via the increase in carboxylated osteocalcin. So several studies demonstrating the increase in bone mineral density using vitamin K2, in particular MK7. Other important indications are in individuals with chronic kidney disease or who are on hemodialysis. So kidney failure is responsible for excessive calcification as the kidneys are not able to excrete calcium. And it's been now demonstrated that vitamin K2 can be implicated for chronic kidney patients to reduce the risk of heart disease. Of note is that the phosphate binder medications tend to bind vitamin K, and so they're discovering now that patients with kidney failure will also have are at increased risk of heart disease if they are on these phosphate binders due to the vitamin K deficiencies. A famous Rotterdam study, a population-based study of 4,807 healthy men and women over the age of 55, demonstrates that vitamin K2 resulted in a 50% reduced risk of heart disease mortality and 25% risk of all-cause mortality when given with dietary intakes of vitamin K2 per day. So the black bar is the incidence of cardiovascular health disease. The darker green is mortality. The lighter green is severe calcification, and the gray is all-cause mortality. So all incidences go down with consumption of vitamin K2. This is a great article and resource if you're interested to learn more about the role of vitamin K in calcium and bone. So here it gives you providing strong evidence on vitamin K7 in particular and its role in increasing bone mineral content. Here is a list of the recommended intakes of vitamin K based on life stage and gender for Europe, the US, and for Australia and New Zealand. So that could be useful for you as a tool. There's also been studies demonstrated in athletes that vitamin K2 has been used to improve arterial flexibility and improving maximal cardiac output in trainers. Lastly, I would like to talk about menopause. So this is a condition, again, where we can say do nothing unless the symptoms are intolerable. The most common concerns for menopause include hot flashes, insomnia, moodiness, vaginal dryness. And then a common question is, are natural products safe to take during or after breast cancer? I wanted to touch briefly on black cohosh. It's been the most extensively studied natural product for hot flashes. Unfortunately, the scientific evidence on its efficacy is lacking. It has not been shown to be as effective at controlling hot flashes compared to placebo. And interestingly enough, the scientific evidence also shows that it's not estrogenic and can be used alongside estrogen blockers, and that it is now known to be relatively safe, and concerns for liver toxicity are not warranted. And the source reference for these can be found in the reference below. However, women still use and find benefit from black cohosh, both for hot flashes and in addition for depression. Here's a small study looking at a common SSRI, fluoxetine or black cohosh. And the black cohosh demonstrated benefits both in the Cooperman index of hot flashes and menopausal symptoms, as well as the Beck's depression scale after 3 months. Dong Quai is a common natural product as well that's being now studied. There's been one small study demonstrating benefit in combination with chamomile on hot flashes and sleep. In Chinese medicine, it's known as a liver and blood tonic, and those are the actions through which it can potentially have its role in alleviating symptoms. And in 55 postmenopausal women, we saw a 90 to 90% reduction compared to placebo after 12 weeks of use. Red clover in the science has been demonstrated to improve mood and cognitive symptoms. There are three small studies demonstrating its effects. For cognitive symptoms, red clover showed a significant decrease in hot flashes and a significant improvement for lack of concentration. The Nudes formula Menopeace has a combination of these ingredients. So it does contain the black cohosh, the dong quai, the red clover. It also contains other herbs like chaste tree, dandelion, and wild yam. These have not been studied particularly in the science, in the scientific literature for menopause, but in traditional practices, they are used for symptoms associated with menopause. And it's a top seller in the company, and it's been known to help reduce hot flashes and overall mood in women who have symptoms associated with menopause. So why would we use herbal extracts in women post-menopause? The active compound terpenoids, they tend to mimic steroids or hormones, and can potentially offer cancer protection. And so different herbal extracts or different compounds in different foods can offer protective effects. More to be researched in the scientific literature, however. Some of these herbal extracts also contain isoflavones and polyphenolics that offer antioxidant protection during periods of low estrogen and influence estrogen receptors in target tissues. So one of the important take-home messages that I would like to leave you with is that estrogen actually acts as an antioxidant for women. And so post-menopause, the addition of antioxidants is especially important and can play a major role in prevention of many preventable diseases. In additionally, the isoflavones in certain herbal extracts or in foods can influence estrogen receptors via their role as a phytoestrogen. So some of the key learning points I hope you can take home is that women's health is multifactorial, cyclical, and vulnerable. Providing a supportive environment is necessary. Under the influence of fluctuating hormones, the challenge is in managing or learning and not controlling these biological chemicals is an important consideration. Estrogens offer oxidative protection, and this is one of the most influential benefits that's often ignored or not talked about. And so I invite you to look this up, find out more information, describe this benefit of estrogen. Estrogen has such a negative reputation when in fact it's an important hormone in women's health and is very protective for a lot of health concerns. So lastly, I hope that this can help you greater target your approach to women's health, that you have access to some studies and some information that can guide you in selecting different dietary supplements alongside your nutrition plan, your exercise plan, or any other psychological or psycho-spiritual plan that you wish to employ with your patients. And here's information on where you can access and how you can access New Roots Herbal products. They are available for purchase at the Natural Dispensary, or you can contact us at info@newrootsherbal.eu or by dialing area code 44-792-781-7354. I thank you very much for your time today. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer. Have a good day.